Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to Tech Tuesday from All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. There are less than 75 days until Christmas, and how we shop is changing thanks to technology, specifically AI. More shoppers are turning to artificial intelligence to help, and a new study shows just how the technology is shaping consumer behavior. Luca Chan is a professor of marketing at the Darden School of Business at the University of Virginia. His research focuses on consumer psychology, particularly how people interact with AI. Welcome to All Sides, Professor.
Thank you so much for having me, Amy. I'm excited to be here.
So you've conducted some award-winning research into consumer shopping habits and AI, finding that nearly 60% of shoppers do use AI to shop. So how exactly are consumers using AI for their shopping? What are they doing?
That's a great question. I think the key in all of this is how naturally AI fits into behaviors people already have. Like, these tools don't force us to adopt something entirely new. They improve familiar habits. And so they use AI from searching for product till helping decision about even what to wear. We even found that 46% of people trust AI more than a friend on certain subjects. So I think AI is very is everywhere right now, from searching reviews to helping them selecting a product to even, choosing what to wear.
Yeah. And are we talking about all kinds of shopping, or is it mainly clothing, or are they doing it for like all kinds of products, anything you can imagine?
Everything you can imagine. Now, there is a big difference, though. What we found in our research is that for, say, utilitarian products, think of a dishwasher, a winter coat, a laptop, people really trust AI. So whatever recommendation an AI has, usually people tend to follow and actually prefer the AI recommendation over the one of a friend or a human, because they think AI is more competent in those kind of choices. But when you think about what we call hedonic purchases, that are like, think of experiential purchases, a good bottle of wine, a nice cloth to buy, etc., then people are still a little resistant to AI and may prefer recommendations made by a person, by a human.
Yeah, I could definitely see that, where if someone's going to recommend a new food to me or a particular brand of wine, I would trust a human to have tasted it rather than AI. So AI can recommend the refrigerator to me, but maybe not the food inside, because I know AI hasn't tasted it, right? Because I do know it's a computer.
That's true. But what we thought was interesting is that even when you think about reviews, so imagine we ask a person or an AI to read reviews about wine, and then we ask other people which one would they prefer. In that case, an AI is perfectly able to read reviews about wine, but still people prefer humans, even though it was not just a tasting contest. But this could change quickly, right? So we found even recently that 46% of people are preferring AI opinions on what to wear, so something taste-related, over their opinion of a friend. So I think this could change really quickly once people understand that AI, although it doesn't have necessarily a taste, but is able to understand our taste preferences and what people in general think.
What about the idea of mass searching for sales? Everyone's always looking for a deal. Can AI properly find you the lowest price and where to buy it?
Oh, that's such a great question. It's improving a lot. I would say right now it could help if the sale is, it's at least a sale that has been discussed in forums. It has been there for a certain some long time. Think about a month or two. But it's something like a flash sale that is like only a few hours long, and its AI is not yet up to date, and so it's not really able to get those kind of promotion and sales. But I feel that in the future, that may be changing. If when, for example, I can see, for example, Amazon already right now having some collaboration with Anthropics, that is a creator of AI infrastructure. So maybe in the future, Amazon and an AI system will be, for example, able to collaborate on and sharing sales promotion on Amazon. Same things with Walmart. So I think these things can change in the future, but we are not yet there.
Amazon does have an AI tool known as Rufus. It's a conversational assistant. Can you tell me more about that? I've never used Rufus. What does Rufus do?
Yeah, I think Amazon is moving forward. Back in the day, it was just other people like you would buy this product, right? So, and now with Rufus, they try to understand customer preferences and be more conversational and personalized. So, maybe back in the day, if you buy a product, you would just say, "Oh, other people bought a similar product or a complementary product." But right now, it's more like, "Hey, Amazon, I'm looking for a gift for a friend of mine who lives in Boston. What would you recommend?" Right? And so Rufus is trying to understand those kind of questions, and also could be very relevant because its base knows consumer preferences, so sort of try to predict what a person could buy.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about how artificial intelligence is changing consumer shopping habits with marketing professor Luca Chan, from the University of Virginia's Darton School of Business. So last week, Trey Bodge, a smart shopping expert who has 5 million followers on X, had a press event, and she talked about the AI tools that Amazon and others are using. Here she is talking about one known as Interests.
You have a tricky person on your list. It's very good for that as well. So, for example, you could say, I have a friend who loves cooking. They're really into cookbooks and innovative cooking tools. Interest will comb through Amazon and find all the applicable products for that. And so, it's a great way to discover new products. It'll let you know if there are deals, new product drops, product availability. So, it does all that legwork for you.
So, can AI really help me if I have someone on my shopping list who is just notoriously difficult to shop for and you can't buy them a good gift if your life depended on it? Do you think AI can actually find the right gift for that person?
I think it could help, but we are still needed in the final decision, right? So AI are not mind reader, but given all the amount of data that they can access quickly, they can have nice and quick predictions. And sometimes I think it can be used also to generate ideas that we may not consider immediately, right? So could expand our creativity in some ways, proposing product that we would never think of, but could fit that person profile or interest. So I think could be very useful to suggest a set of products, but of course, so far, we are still the best one to understand what our friend may like.
So you note that companies are not trying to just win over consumers now. Now they have to try to win over AI systems to force AI systems to recommend their products. So how are the marketing executives of these companies adapting? Are they marketing to humans and they need to market to AI?
Yes, that's a 1 billion question, 50 billion question. But absolutely right. We are in an exciting time where brands are a little bit struggling to understand how to communicate with AI. And so right now, brands don't need to only to gain the consumer trust, but also AI trust, right? Whatever AI may propose to the customer is what the customer or the user will read. And so it's very important to understand, and everyone is trying to figure it out, how to gain a spot in what ChatGPT or other LLMs will propose you when they say, okay, my final recommendation about, I don't know, the shoes you should buy are these five shoes, right? So how can you get in these five spots is something that every brand is considering. And right now is based most probably also on online discussions and content. So there could be a positive side in this, like in the future, those selections or the favorite products that you may consider are not only based on advertising, but mostly on positive content over the internet. So there could be sort of a democratization, if you wish, of good products. When a product is well discussed over the internet and there's positive review, that could become one of the favorite products by AI to suggest to the final user.
Are companies investing a lot in AI? Because obviously Amazon is, but what about smaller companies that have a marketing department and want to get their products in front of the eyes of people? Do they need to have AI on the back end of their company in order to use AI on the front end?
Yes, absolutely yes. There are even some companies now that are trying to be AI first, meaning they're trying to develop their content strategy, not anymore like in you know, trying to persuade the someone who actually arrives in their webpage, for example, but they're trying to develop their content so that could be easily or could be picked up by AI in an easier way. Mm-hmm. So I think in the future, all companies, small or big, have to adapt to AI, try to create, to gain the trust of AI. And so developing content that they hope AI will pick up and then will ultimately pass on the final customer or user.
How will this impact smaller businesses then? Because I assume that they do not have any AI optimization methods. Are they going to just get washed away by bigger brands because they can't afford to keep up?
Ooh, that's such a good philosophical question. I think we could go both ways, right? So on the one hand, yes, like massive businesses right now have a lot of money that can create be better prepared to create content that AI will pick up. But on the other hand, this is actually creating opportunities maybe for small businesses in a way that we haven't seen before. Because like platforms like Shopify are building AI tools that small businesses can plug in their stores without needing, you know, a tech team or a huge budget, right? And small boutique can now offer personalized recommendations just like Amazon does. Like with all these tools right now, people can, you don't need a computer scientist anymore to create AI first website or AI first content. Of course, if you have it, it's better, but there are so many tools that small businesses can use to create a content that is AI optimized.
I can see a lot of benefits. I mean, to help you with your shopping, you can find more unique gifts. AI will just, you know, do a better job of finding you products with good reviews. But what are some potential downfalls here? Is there any concern that the human experience is going to be completely removed from the equation? This is just another way that algorithms are going to push into our shopping subconscious.
Right. That's a problem. So, well, in one of my pieces of research, we found, for example, that people are less forgiving when AI gets it wrong compared to a human. So far, at least, people are overgeneralizing AI mistakes. What I mean here is that, for example, you're using an AI for a website, and this AI makes a mistake, then you all of a sudden think, my God, everything AI-based from this company is a mess, right? So when if you were interacting with a person, you may think, well, this person maybe not was not maybe the best person, but I will not assume that everyone working for this company is problematic, right? So people tend sort of when they encounter mistakes with AI, people overgeneralize the mistake to all the company. So that's a tale of caution there, but again, things could change there. But in general, I would say the best case scenario is what I call AI augmented scenario, where there is a collaboration between human and AI, right? Yes, AI will create great recommendations, but people are still skeptical, sometimes in terms of privacy or sometimes in what research called black box, right? So I have no idea how AI is arriving to a decision. So people sometimes think I can understand what's in another person's mind, but I cannot understand what's going on in the AI mind. And that's curious because right now I don't understand what's in your mind, Amy, right? But I think I may be able. But when I interact with an AI, I have no idea what's going on behind the scenes. And so people are still very skeptical about AI. So not very, but there is some skepticism. I think company, for this reason, I try to show to increase transparency in the way they operate. But of course, there are some concerns in terms of privacy, black box, et cetera, et cetera. But so far, I wouldn't be too worried that AI is taking over our human touch. But in the future, there may be a scenario where AI is, especially agentic AI, will do most of our shoppings because they will know us very well. And they know what we miss or we need at a specific point. So it will automate a lot of shopping and decisions.
We've been talking with Luca Chan, a professor of marketing at Darden's School of Business at the University of Virginia. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be here.
And coming up, we're going to talk with two Ohio universities about how they're teaming up for research. That's when Tech Tuesday from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday from All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Following the Trump administration's funding cuts, universities across the country have lost money for their research projects. The University of Cincinnati and Kent State University are working together to provide a solution to their financial needs. It's called the Supporting and Harmonizing Research Endeavors Program, also known as the SHARE Program. And joining us now, we have Jane Stosser, Senior Associate Vice President for Research at the University of Cincinnati. Welcome, Jane.
Good morning.
And also we have Doug Delahanty, Vice President of Research and Economic Development and President and CEO of the Kent State Research Corporation. Welcome to All Sides, Doug.
Hi, Amy.
So both of you lead this SHARE program, and Jane, let's start with you. First of all, great acronym, you know, Supporting and Harmonizing Research Endeavors, SHARE. So what made you decide that this was the solution for your two universities?
Well, I'll let Doug talk about part of it, which is a program that was developed through the Association of American Public and Land Grant Universities. We've been working together for a long time and we've been trying to build resources. It's very hard to maintain staffing levels, and smaller institutions really struggle to have the infrastructure that's required to support research. So as we're, the University of Cincinnati is a relatively large research university and we have a fairly large infrastructure, but we do have people come and go. So there are times when we're short staffed and there's times when we have a little bit of extra capacity. And so it helps to share with our neighbors. So we've been able to do that. For example, with Miami University, we were able to provide them with an institutional biosafety committee while they reorganized their compliance office. So that's where we started.
Yeah. So, Doug, how quickly were you able to stand up this initiative? I mean, did it predate the Trump administration's recent cuts, or was it just motivated by it?
I think it was honestly both. We had been pursuing funding through NSF to support this project, and the project kind of has two arms. One is a leadership development aspect, and that's really building upon work that Jane and I and our colleague Jim Reese at Iowa State are engaged in to provide just broad understanding of all the things overseen in the research office. And so it provides both peer and senior networking and mentoring. And we're really excited about increasing the level which we're able to provide that to institutions. We'll develop various different, what we're calling regional communities of practice in different states that will build up this infrastructure for research development. And then Jane's overseeing the part that is really increasing compliance resources. And so to build on what she was saying at Kent, which is a slightly smaller shop, for us to get to more complicated research or faculty who are engaged in different things that might be FDA related or might be military related, the levels of compliance go up substantially. And we don't have the ability to build out an office in anticipation of that success. And so you find yourself in this weird spot where we are not compliant if we hit on a proposal that somebody submitted. And so being able to share parts of people is something that's really of interest of smaller and emerging research institutions.
And you mentioned that you were awarded a National Science Foundation grant, $3 million, to collaborate like this. Is it just ironic that you, you know, are collaborating more because of lost grants, but then you got a grant?
I think we had started this before any of the grant is a time intensive process, and typically there's revisions and other things. So we had started it prior to. I think it is fortuitous at this stage to have the funds to be able to allow our neighboring institutions to have resources that they wouldn't be able to have right now and that they're struggling with. And so I do think it also builds an infrastructure just base collaboration that will hopefully increase the number of proposals that institutions do together, and really just provide some of these skills and training for individuals who are interested in being support at their institutions for people engaged in the research process.
Now, Jane, the University of Cincinnati and Kent State are not exactly neighbors. You know, they're on different sides of Ohio. But so I'm guessing you're not maybe sharing a lab or actual equipment, but is this, it's behind the scenes things that you're sharing? Doug mentioned compliance officers and all of the stuff you have to do on the back end.
So we created the RCOPs to be within 300 miles of each other. So they're driving distance because we thought that would be a very important barrier to collaboration. Mm-hmm. We are focused primarily on building the infrastructure that supports research, so the research administration and compliance, to buffer the ebbs and flows of staffing and research demands, but also as we make it easier for institution for research by sharing the platforms that on which we operate, we make it easier for research to be shared as well. And so it's certainly possible that there could be equipment or labs that were shared with Kent State, but most of that would probably be more regional in southwestern Ohio for us.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the SHARE program, supporting and harmonizing research endeavors between the University of Cincinnati and Kent State University, with their program leads, Jane Stosser and Doug Delahenty. So you just mentioned what you called, did you call them RCOPs, regional communities of practice? So your model develops regional communities of practice, and this model is going to be used in other states. So, Jane, can you explain that? So is it RCOP? Is that what you called it?
So that, again, the idea is that we would start locally. We're going to, in addition to providing shared staffing, we're trying to develop tools and resources that help the smaller institutions and any institution to address their research infrastructure needs, their compliance needs. And initially, we wanted to start in a state for two reasons. One is so that in addition to being compliant with the federal laws, everybody was following the same state laws. Right. So we didn't have an extra level of complexity. And then the other one is to start to really build community. So we're starting in Ohio, and then we'll spend 2 years in Ohio developing the model and testing it. And then in year three, we'll test it in Iowa. So we'll go to a totally different state where we can see if the lessons that we learned here are more broadly applicable.
Yeah. And Doug, you know, you were quoted in an article talking about the national impact. So tell me, I mean, how big do you see this growing? Do you see this as a model that lots of different areas can use? Because there's lots of universities everywhere that want to do research and maybe just need this help.
Definitely. I think that's really the aim. And so there's a little bit of two parts. So the research development part is honestly easier. We've been overseeing that group through APLU that Jane mentioned for, what, 5-6 years now. And so we have a lot of experience with that. We will set up research leadership RCOPs in 4 states. So we'll go Ohio, then Iowa, Minnesota, and then Georgia. And the agreements that you have to do compliance are a little bit more time consuming. And so the intent there is to develop the first RCOP with regards to compliance in Ohio, and then, as Jane said, the second one in Iowa and test it. But I think that if we're able to show how you can share parts of people, which is something that is a difficult concept for some to wrap their minds around, that is really beneficial to emerging research institutions. But I will say, and Jane always says the same thing, which is it's also equally beneficial to the big institutions because they have needs also. And I think one of the things that we've really learned working together is that the challenges faced by smaller research institutions really are mirrored by larger ones at the same time. And so there's a lot that we can do together.
Can either of you give me an example of some research that one of your universities is involved in that you're hoping can expand, or this partnership is going to really help the research get off the ground?
I can do that, I think. We have a newer College of Aeronautics and Engineering. They do a lot of drones, UAVs, other types of research that touches more into potential military aspects. And so this is things that we talk about, and it's called export control related type research, which is just terminology. And the reality is we do not have an office of export control that can work with people as they pursue this type of funding. Those individuals are very expensive to hire, and it would be difficult for me to build up an office when I don't have people hitting on those proposals yet, but they will hit on them soon. So you find yourself at this place where if they hit on them and you don't have the resources, you're in trouble. So how do we adapt to that? And the ideal is, well, Jane has an office just like that. And if their folks are not 100% being used at University of Cincinnati, if I can buy consulting skills from some of them at a cheaper price than hiring a full-time person, that is a much better approach as we build our expertise.
And that helps us because we don't necessarily keep people at 100%, right? There's always hopefully a little bit of space so that if somebody takes a vacation day or something, the institution doesn't shut down. So that helps us buffer any extra capacity we might have.
And can you talk to me about this helping smaller institutions? I mean, University of Cincinnati and Kent State are large compared to some of the really small universities we have in this state. But it must be hard for all of them, your two included, to compete with the Ohio States of the world when there's limited research dollars. So what does this have to offer for even smaller institutions than yours?
So whereas we're looking at things like export control, we have worked very closely with basically all the institutions in Ohio already in putting this grant together. So we had support letters from virtually every institution of higher ed in Ohio. And quotes from others were things like, we really need help just with some of our human subjects research. So being compliant with different things, like it is new to us to be working with hospitals, and we're not sure how you write up institutional review board applications and things like that for working with a hospital. So can we borrow somebody from Kent State, because we're real good at that, and we could offer that to whatever entity is looking for those types of things. And so I do think it is not just that everybody's going to be bothering Jane at Cincinnati for resources. It is each one of these institutions has skill sets they're good at that could be borrowed from each other. So that's just one example.
Think of it as a co-op model where we sort of share.
Okay. And back to that competing, though, is it hard to compete with the Ohio States of the world? Does the bulk of the research dollars go to Ohio State just because they have more capacity, but this will make you more competitive?
I don't see that as the goal. The goal really is, in these RCOPs, is to develop the infrastructure to be leaner and faster and stronger, and then to benefit everybody that's involved and in the entire region indirectly by the economic impact that the funding brings.
Doug, WOSU is here at Ohio State University, so I'm well aware of the bureaucracy that some universities bring. Do you have any trouble with working through the bureaucracy if you're sharing people? Will the university let you, just like contract out with someone for, here and there?
I think that's the challenge, and I think that's where we're able to leverage. One of the reasons we're starting in Ohio, obviously, is Jane and I are both in Ohio. There are VPs of research at six other institutions in Ohio who all came through the same leadership program that we've been co-leading. And so we have a group of individuals who are highly collaborative and recognize the benefits of sharing that far exceed the competitive part. So the idea that even though people are competing for grants, the shared infrastructure provides that ability much more equally. And I think that's where we're real excited about it. And I think Jane has experience, as she's already mentioned, with some of the legal documents that typically have to stall things, but they have ones that have already been approved by legal that we can then use as models to make this easier for everybody. And that's really the goal.
How long would you say the process is going to be before this is in Iowa, in Georgia, in Minnesota?
So the leadership development, we are hiring a project director hopefully this week. We're just good at that. We have eight new members of the existing cohort that we've been building. Every year we do that. So we can do that very quickly. So each year we'll have the leadership development in Ohio, then we'll do Iowa, then, like I said, Minnesota, then Georgia. It's a little longer to do the things that require compliance and agreements that institutions will have to sign with each other. And that's why we're going to take 2 years to do the compliance portion in Ohio and then test that again in Iowa for 2 years and then provide models that others can use. And if there's additional funding, we can move one to Minnesota and follow what we've been doing.
And so the program is called Supporting and Harmonizing Research Endeavors, which spells out SHARE. Who's going to take credit for a great acronym like that?
Oh, Jane did that 100%.
Were you trying to spell SHARE, or did you have all these words and it just worked out for you?
I was trying to find an acronym.
Yeah.
That I liked.
Yeah, it's a good name. It's a good name. Okay, so Doug just kind of laid out the next steps. Jane, what would you see as the next steps for you, or what do you want people to know about this program and its future?
Well, we're starting primarily in southwestern Ohio. My goal is to have, I think our goal is to have to give research and institutions of higher education some resilience as we move through the next few years, and increase our capacity, hopefully so that we can all get through this with minimal damage.
Yeah, when you say that you want resilience, meaning so that your research institutions can stay open, can keep doing what they're doing, that kind of thing. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. And, you know, we are facing a demographic cliff with universities as well. We need to be thoughtful stewards of the public dollars. And we need to maximize the impact of those dollars on what we do and how we impact our trainees, their job preparedness, and the knowledge and startups that we spin off from our research endeavors.
We've been talking about a program called Supporting and Harmonizing Research Endeavors, also known as SHARE, and it is between the University of Cincinnati and Kent State University and growing. We've been talking with program leader Jane Stosser. Thank you for your time today, Jane.
Thank you.
And Doug Delahenty. Thank you for your time today, Doug.
Thanks so much, Amy.
And this is Tech Tuesday on 89.7 NPR News. Coming up, we are going to talk about the popular social media platform Discord and why that name is very apt for them right now. That's when Tech Tuesday continues from all sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. And this is Tech Tuesday, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. The popular social media platform Discord was recently hit a wave of its namesake, Discord, when a security breach on the website exposed government IDs for over 70,000 users. According to Discord, the information is being used as a ransom to extort money from the company. Joining us to discuss this is Russell Holly, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday, Russell.
Thank you.
So what do we know about who hacked Discord to steal this information? Do we know who they are?
Aside from, you know, the name of a fairly nebulous group that has reached out, you know, kind of separately to Discord, they're not doing as much in the way of, you know, kind of publicly broadcasting what information they have available to them. But the what information was made clear was that, you know, the information that Discord had collected over the course of many, many years in order to verify that you are a sufficient age. Is the specific information that these people have access to.
So they have access to government IDs. Why did Discord have all of these government IDs in the first place?
You have to be 13 or older to use Discord in US and Canada. And once you are above 18, you are able to access Discord channels that contain what the company considers, you know, adult content, be it language or imagery or what have you. And in order to, you know, demonstrate that you are 18 and over, in some cases, Discord will ask for a photo ID to be sent to them for verification. Okay. So that's what you're seeing here, is essentially a lot of pictures of people's driver's licenses or government IDs.
Okay, so basically people want to be able to get into these forums that are for adults 18 and up, so they had to upload their government ID at some point.
That's right. If someone had a you know, an account when they were 14 and they checked the box when they created an account that said, you know, that they were above age 13, and then they started, you know, trying to get into those adult channels 4 years later, then there would be a pop-up on Discord that asked for you to verify your age.
So are there, basically, is Discord going to pay the ransom, or like what is happening? What's the latest information there?
Yeah, it's not immediately clear, you know, what information, you know, Discord is willing to, I guess, pay for in this context. You know, there's a lot of frustration with Discord's audience, the readers, especially in places outside of Discord, like Reddit and other forums, have been expressing, you know, frustration for quite some time now. There, you know, in the middle of this data breach, there have been other users who have been trying to, you know, verify ID in order to gain access to those platforms as well. And that service is not currently available because it, you know, isn't currently demonstrated to be safe. So Discord as a company is really facing quite a bit of internal backlash from its own audience at the moment.
Are they asking law enforcement for help in catching the hacker, or are they on their own?
Yeah, law enforcement has been involved in you know, forensic detectives are trying to look at, you know, what information can be recovered and you know, also what the validity of the claims are, because there hasn't been, you know, like a very public breach in order to identify which people, you know, the data, you know, belongs to. So there are a lot of open questions at the moment, and that is typical of things that are, you know, just you know, in the middle of an investigation. So the best recommendation here is that if you are a Discord user, in particular, a younger Discord user, someone who has really only been using it for the last 2 or 3 years and is in that, you know, 18 to 21 age group, you know, there are a couple of steps that you have available to you. The very first is kind of the most obvious one. Make sure that your passwords are changed and that two-factor authentication is on if you decide to continue to use Discord. If you have sent your ID to Discord at some point in the last couple of years, it is probably a really good idea to sign up for some sort of, you know, kind of identification validation service. A lot of them are free, and you know what they do is they you know monitor credit services and things like that. So if your ID starts doing things like trying to sign up for credit cards, that you're notified ahead of time, and there are freezes that can be put in those places.
Has Discord said they're going to do anything to make their site more secure in the future?
You know, the problem that we're running into here is that Discord wasn't the one that was storing the information. It was all kind of gone through a third party. And this raises a really interesting set of challenges because, you know, there's a level of privacy and security that is, you know, supposed to be guaranteed. The idea of creating these age gates is to make sure that kids are safe. And you know, Discord is very far from the only company doing this. It was just a little over a month ago that we were talking about YouTube doing something very similar in order to make sure that kids weren't accessing content that they shouldn't have access to. You know, providing that age verification is really important, but we live in a world where it feels like there are data breaches on a fairly regular basis. So providing that information in order to get the service is a challenge.
The infamous third party vendor too, you know, where
that's right.
Yeah. All right. Well, moving on to our next topic, it is the Google Pixel 10, a foldable phone that was recently released for a whopping $1,799. And many users are questioning whether the device is worth that much. So, Russell, is the Google Pixel 10 foldable phone worth $1,800?
I think it is absolutely worth $1,800 if this is your primary computer. And what I mean by that is we're in kind of an interesting, you know, kind of tech landscape here at the moment, in that within weeks of one another, the thinnest iPhone to have been made in quite some time and the lightest iPhone to have been made in quite some time and the heaviest Pixel phone have been made at the same time. And they serve wildly different audiences, right? Like Google's Pixel 10 looks like a phone, you know, like looks like any other phone from the front, but you can actually open it like you would a book. And you now have this much larger screen on the inside that you can use to do a ton of different things. It is the first one of these folding phones that is both dust and water resistant to a level that is comparable to a phone that does not fold, which is a you know, kind of a breakthrough in and of itself. With that giant, you know, kind of body, you get incredibly long battery life, the ability to, you know, watch and consume and contribute, you know, in a bunch of different ways. If you are like me and just are, you know, saddled with gigantic thumbs, having that much wider keyboard is actually really nice to type on. But also, you know, knowing that this one thing that you bring around is kind of the only computer that you need is something that, you know, not a small amount of people rely on day-to-day basis. So I think, yes, it is an expensive phone for sure. But when you think about it also replacing maybe a tablet, or in some very specific cases, if you have, you know, if you're okay with typing in this way, it can functionally replace a laptop in very specific situations.
Yeah. Okay. So this foldable phone, I thought this whole foldable phone trend was to make the phone smaller. Like you fold it and it becomes smaller. But
those very much exist. When you talk about folding phones, it's really interesting because there is very much two different groups. There are people who want a normal phone that can become a giant phone, and there are people who want a small phone that temporarily becomes a full-size phone.
Yeah.
And this is very much the former.
Okay, so this Pixel 10 is a standard-size smartphone, and then it unfolds, and it's like a mini tablet. So people want this larger surface area. So it's still a phone, but it's also like, it looked like a mini tablet to me.
It does. When it's open, it really, you know, it's a very large screen. You can run multiple programs side by side. So if you are in the middle of talking to someone, but you also need, you know, navigation on because you're walking through a city you've never been in before, it's possible to have those things, you know, kind of operate at the same time. But if you really just need to, you know, open your phone and check your text messages, then you have a full screen on the front that you can very much use the same way that you would use any other Pixel or any other iPhone.
Okay, so you can leave it folded and use it like a phone, the normal size, and then you open it up and it becomes a tablet and you can do more things. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. So you explained, is it it's priced so high because it is basically like a phone and a tablet and a computer all combined into one?
This really is, you know, both physically and as far as what it's capable of, essentially two phones that have been glued together with a very, you know, foldy screen in the middle.
That seems simple, but I'm sure the technology is much more complicated
That's
than
right.
that. Yes. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and this is Tech Tuesday. We're talking with Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET, about some recent tech news. And California recently passed the Commercial Advertisement Loudness Mitigation Act, also known as the CALM Act, starting in July of next year. This will ban ads on streaming services that are louder than the shows that they are placed between. So, Russell, what was the motivation for this act? And is it just in California?
So the law is just in California, but it is likely that the platforms that this impacts, especially since a lot of those companies are based in California, especially mm-hmm. Netflix and Hulu and Disney, you know, in many of those cases, I suspect it'll be something that is, you know, impacts a much broader audience than just the citizens of California. But I don't know a person who isn't familiar with the idea of an ad being louder than the show they're watching, and not just on streaming platforms, but on terrestrial television as well in some cases. You know, there are, it has been a problem for a really long time. It's been an inconvenience, certainly, for a really long time to have, you know, those two audio platforms do something different. And this is a situation where tech companies have tried various ways to fix this with hardware. So Roku and TiVo, for those who remember that platform, you know, there have been attempts, you know, over the last 20 years to have a hardware way to make sure that the volume is the same regardless of what's coming in, you know, through the wire. And none of them have really ever been 100% successful. So I think looking at that, California decided that, you know, it has been quite long enough for these companies to try and solve it themselves, and that mandating this solution is, you know, kind of the next step forward.
I mean, I can remember this being a huge problem years ago where all the ads seemed louder than the TV shows. But I feel like it's gotten under control a little bit. Or is it just the shows I'm watching have quieter ads? I don't know.
I think it also depends on how you're watching. So if you're watching on something like an Apple TV, you're less likely to notice because Apple's, you know, physical hardware does.
I have Apple TV. There you go.
That's right. Yeah. So Apple TV on a hardware level does some of what we were talking about earlier and trying to balance that audio so that it doesn't work. If you have Roku branded televisions, those are also, you're less likely to notice it because the, you know, Roku has the entire operating system for the television to control. But there is a whole wide world of folks out there who are watching on different things and having a very different experience from you and I.
Interesting. How are advertising companies responding to this? I mean, do they want their ads to be loud?
Yes, everyone wants their ad to be something that causes the other person in the room, you know, to look up and see what's going on the screen, either because it's exciting or you know, the music is thrilling or something like that. You know, in many of those cases, you know, that is seen as a way to grab someone's attention, not just if they're in their home, but if you're in a doctor's office or you know, something like that, you know, being able to grab that call. There have been several marketing firms who have released statements over the last couple of weeks saying that they were pushing to self-regulate and solve this themselves without California's, you know, legal system needing to get involved. But, you know, they have They have been not able to regulate themselves for a little over 15 years at this point, as far as, you know, the history of streaming platforms. So it's tough to say one way or the other which was the best way to go, but we'll see how this works out for California for the next little while.
And this is just streaming services, so not cable TV or over-the-air TV?
That's right. Yeah, cable TV is going to function very much the same way that it always had. But if you are watching something on any of the US-based streaming services, you know, so this wouldn't apply if you were watching something like BritBox or something like that. But if you're watching Netflix or Hulu or, you know, Disney Plus or something like that, then this is going to apply to them.
Interesting. Okay. So, but so over the air TV, that, have they figured out how to regulate this a long time ago? I feel like I don't think ads scream at me whenever I'm watching over the air TV.
Over the air TV has had less of this problem over time in some cases because, you know, there were hardware boxes like DVRs and things like that that would fix it automatically. If something was recorded via DVR, it would make sure that all the audio was the same level. And so even if it, you know, it didn't remove commercials in the same way that TiVo used to or that some of the other DVRs would, then, you know, the audio volume would be kind of leveled out. But even for that, it's not always the case that you know, the commercials aren't a different volume.
Hmm. Well, I want to thank you for your time today. You've been listening to Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce Content for CNET. Thank you for your time, Russell.
Thanks for having me.
And you're listening to Tech Tuesday on 89.7 NPR News. And I want to say thank you to our staff, producers Marcus Charleston and Aaron Esmont Rabinowitz, student producers Iza Huck, Colin Simpson, and Kiara Burson, video production by The Ohio Channel, board operation by Chris Johnston and Cameron Howard. And if you missed any part of today's show, find it at WOSU.org/allsides or subscribe to our podcast. This is 89.7 NPR News.